Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. My next guest is going to be speaking with talking about the new India. What's happening in India? And indeed, delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line this morning from Bombay, which I don't think I've done an international or a far-reaching call like this for a very long time. But I'm joined by the author of a thought-provoking new book called The New India. And I hope I'm going to get the name right. It's Rahul Bhatia. Am I getting things slightly right there, Rahul?
You are getting things slightly right there, George.
Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too well. It's been a bit of a morning so far, but if we keep smiling, I'm sure it'll be 12 o'clock soon, and I can knock off. Now, the book is called A New India. We have heard lots of things about India. This is a comprehensive work, and when the press notes landed on my desk about this, I thought, blimey, that's a big call. Because this is a country that, as a British person, and I'm using this word advisedly, especially today, and as somebody who is also an immigrant, because I'm living in a different country, and we as British think we have some sort of idea of India, but really our idea of India basically stems from what we would call the empire, or Indians would call something else entirely. And all of that previous knowledge doesn't take in any of the history, if you like, pre-Raj, shall we say. And your book makes a statement about democracy, and is democracy even something that India is ready for or has a history for? So I will let you now do the talking.
Well, Giles, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. You're right. I think it is a large book, and it's actually a large book because I really let my curiosity guide me through this whole process over here. People outside the country say, "Well, India is intimidating. It's huge. They don't really get it. It's a complicated place." Well, sitting inside India, I can tell you pretty much, it's the same for us as well. There's never a dull day. There's always something new going on that's constantly surprising you. And just when you think you've got a handle on the country, it comes along and reminds you that, no, you absolutely do not. So this book essentially happened because, like I was saying to you before we just began over here, I've been here for about 22 years now. And in that time, India has changed out of sight, in the way we think about democracy, in the way we speak to each other, in, the values that we have. Things have changed because this is a country that's changing, that is currently trying to, really find its roots, find its feet. And at some level, it's still a really young country. It's not that old. 75 years is not a very long time.
Can you argue? And this is please shoot me down in flames a bit if I get this completely wrong. But is there an argument that India has been, as colonial powers have done time and time again, they've drawn up lines, they've put on boundaries, they don't understand the country? I'm thinking obviously what's happened with Africa. We will talk about the situation of our partition, and a lot of people still don't get how much of a tearing out that was, partition in 48, if I'm correct, 48, 49, and therefore India as a to be Indian, you not only have the baggage of centuries of a glorious civilization, but you're now trying to reestablish yourself. And does India reestablish itself looking west, looking east, or just looking inwards because India is powerful enough as it is and has its own identity?
I think it's a mix of everything, to be honest. And I don't think people really today understand just how important partition was back in 1947, how traumatic it was. We, at some level today, when we talk about things like nationalism and, you know, majoritarianism and you know, especially religious nationalism, you've got to go a long way back. You've got to go to partition and you've got to see how people were feeling at that point in time. And for me, when I was looking at all of this in the archives, as I was reporting this book and doing my research, I was stunned. I was stunned because I'd always grown up with stories about what partition was like. And I'd heard about the massacres on trains. I'd heard about the extreme violence. But then to hear those stories and sort of internalize them and then see them in front of you in official documents, in police reports, and realize that the stories were far more complicated than they were made out to be, that told me that, all right, we're actually dealing with that kind of trauma. We're dealing with trauma that's not been resolved since then. Issues that were raised back in 1947 still haven't been resolved. And so today, when you look at India and how it's trying to find its feet, it's trying to at one level hold on to this idea of the past, of what had been done to it in the past, and also saying, we've got these millions of young people with us over here with all their dreams and ambitions. Which way are they looking? Are they looking at the Western world in terms of materialism? Are they looking at, you know, are they looking at the East in terms of, you know, the way you sort of resolve your own problems and create your own sort of philosophy? I think we're at this point, it's an uncertain answer, but I think we're getting there. You know, everything you see in India today is essentially a combination of these various pulls and pressures.
But India has this really unique dynamic, which is the fact that you have a large segment of the population who are highly educated, highly literate. They speak English, which, you know, apologies, but in today's world, that's important. Tech savvy, etc. So you've got that one body of people. And then you have rural India, which hasn't really changed, despite partition, despite various empires coming and going, has been the same. You now have a country that is also techno-savvy, so that allows, because obviously the jokes, you know, UK jokes about call centres all going to India, etc., but it's a technological hub. People want to go there because global companies know they can get well-educated, highly intelligent people for very, very low wages, which is another interview in itself. So that means that, but that also means that Indian political parties or Indian influencers, and I don't mean people taking selfies, who want to spread a message to the population, now have the ways of doing it, but it can be very incendiary if people are picking these up, as we've just seen over the weekend in the UK, these messages, and that is a dynamic in itself.
It is a dynamic in itself. You're absolutely right. You know, WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, These are vehicles for a lot of incendiary messages. However, people make the mistake of thinking that this is a modern phenomenon. It's actually not. One of the strengths of the Hindu right, and you know, which we're talking about, when we talk about India today, that's what we're really talking about politically, the rise of the Hindu right. One of the things that the Hindu right actually managed to do very effectively over a century, since about, I would say, 1924, 1925, was learn how to disseminate messages very effectively. They could get a message out in no time at all. And, you know, if somebody at the top had a message to spread, it would move down this very well-defined tree and it would be implemented by people on the streets. And I've looked at reports that show me how rumors were spread in the 1940s at a, you know, just around partition, the way misinformation was spread. And when I looked at all of this, I said, goodness, this is exactly the way it's done today. It's just that the medium has changed. So technology is one aspect of it. I would say that India has changed. You know, rural India has definitely changed. You know, we've moved a lot of people out of poverty and into the middle class. So that's something that you do see. However, the information infrastructure that actually exists as a, you know, as check, you know, as a check and balance, basically, you know, when it comes to sort of checking, you know, the government's claims or checking any other claims, that has not grown as strong as you, as I had hoped it would. You know, that is still a pretty fragile information ecosystem. And so when somebody spreads misinformation, what do you counter it with? Mm. Not just what do you counter it with, but who's doing the countering? How effective is that countering? At the moment, it's not very effective.
Also, because, again, India was seen, has always been seen as this emerging powerhouse, as a superpower, but, oh no, and I know the Indian armed forces are pretty massive, but not in that sort of way, in the terms of intelligence and also, as I said before, technology. There was a move towards an emerging middle class in India. People doing very well, skyscrapers going up, people moving from rural areas to the city. Favorite, you know, Slumdog Millionaire is a film that everybody will have seen, etc. And again, you look at some situations where we have believed that free-ranging capitalism is a good thing, and it will throw open the gates and cut down social barriers. And we tend to forget of the barriers that are in India historically and religiously. And is there a disaffection between people who have tried to break these barriers? Because now I'm thinking, when you get a disaffected group of people, that's when they go, why isn't my life looking like this? And that's when they can be open to suggestion and misinformation.
That's interesting, because when you look at who believes in misinformation, it's not just people who haven't thrived or who economic opportunity has passed them by. It's educated people. It's people who've made the success of themselves. They live in different countries as millionaires. You hear it, you know, these very unlikely, very disturbing things that they say, and you wonder where these ideas are coming from. Now, Giles, you know, I'm going to return to my book, because I'll tell you why. No. I think some of these themes that we're talking about, you know, I really feel like I need to talk about them a little bit, because it was all such a learning for me. I realized that misinformation, or what we call, or rather what you call common knowledge, every society sort of builds a sort of base of common knowledge that, you know, facts that everybody can agree to. But what if that base, that elemental level that society is built on, is infected by really wrong-headed notions, these ideas that kind of seep into a culture over a century or for even longer? You know, for example, let's take the idea that there was once a glorious past, 5,000 years ago, where Indians had invented the plane and had invented telephones and things like that. Now, ordinarily, you'd look at that and say, well, that's clearly wrong. But that kind of idea, that pride in who you were as a civilization, which you really can't argue with people sort of taking pride in who they were and where they came from. But these ideas that you were somehow so advanced, that you had made something 5,000 years before anybody else had even thought about this, where does that take you? That takes you to this idea of supremacy, of you being somewhere in life and you have not received recognition for this. And so that enters the bloodstream of your country, and you have loads of people, hundreds of thousands of people, who believe somewhere at the back of their heads that we were a great civilization. And then that idea is weaponized through politics, through, teachers in alternate school systems, who then tell you, we were great, we were number one, this is who we are. And so that's what you're dealing with. So when you're looking at India today, you're looking at a large number of people who actually believe these ideas, and it's across the board. I'd say that it's not necessarily people who are uneducated or people who haven't had a chance to sort of take advantage of the opportunities this country will give them, the economic opportunities. Some of the most intense conversations I've had with people over the last 7 years, as I reported this book, were with people on the lower end of the economic spectrum who had really suffered as a result of this idea of a great Hindu nation. And when we spoke, it's about rights. It was about believing in the Constitution. I have never had as many conversations about the sanctity of the Constitution and the protections it gives you than I have had with Muslim men whose houses were burnt down during riots. So that's where we're at, you know.
So when it comes to belief, you say there are schools that are teaching quote unquote alternative facts. It's all very well to have a pride in your nation's history. I have a pride in my Scottish, my Welsh, my British, my English heritage, but it's tempered by a knowledge that not everything that we did was great. So the problem is, of course, as we're seeing in other large nations looking across to the United States, if you believe without checks and balances that your nation is the greatest thing that ever happened, if you believe that the Hindu nation invented the aeroplane, then you've got a bit of a problem, surely. And are these people, are established university professors being told you're being unpatriotic? Because there's patriotism, then there's jingoism, and then there's populism, isn't there?
Yes, there is. In fact, plenty of people. So for a while now, there's been, I would say, and there has been control over information. Right now, as we speak today, India is about to introduce a bill that will legislate, you know, online influencers and people who have YouTube shows and radio shows, and bring them under a very stringent broadcasting regulation, which essentially ensures that they will not be able to speak freely. And that's part of what India's been doing now for a little while, which is exercising a certain control over information. This happens everywhere. It happens in universities. It happens on television, on the radio, where you barely hear anything anymore. It happens on the internet. It happens on Twitter. You know, posts that are full of information are taken down. So you see this happening all over the place. And so many people sometimes just don't understand what has happened. If a particular traumatic event has happened, say a pogrom or a riot or something, it tends to pass people by and they're not really aware of it. In schools, in universities, textbooks are being rewritten. Just today, there was news that the preamble of the Constitution, which is, you know, a really soaring piece of writing and meaning, it's being removed from textbooks just today. So, you know, these are things you're dealing with on a daily basis. And you've got a bunch of writers, people, activists, lawyers, reporters, really pushing back against it as hard as they can.
Is there a danger that the powers that be, the autocratic, or those of an autocratic leaning, could say, well, if you look at the history of India, democracy has only been a recent invention for the past 80 years, and we flourished as the great India for thousands of years. Everybody knew their place, and therefore, if we are to go forward, we need a strong man, a strong leader, and therefore, they will be rewriting, because to not rewrite will be seen as unpatriotic.
That's interesting. So we had the elections on June 4th, or rather, June 4th were when the elections were sort of, the results came out. And after 10 years of wanting a strong man, it turned out that people were a little less sure about the effectiveness of a strong man. They saw, I think, in recent months that there was unaccountability. I mean, you know, we haven't really had a press conference with the leaders of this country for almost a decade. So we don't really know. Everything that we come to know about what leadership is doing is essentially through this one-way channel. It's not that you're asking them for questions. It's what they're telling you. And so there's a radio show every alternate Sunday where, you know, the leader is speaking with you. And so I think somewhere what I'm seeing is that people in India are looking at, or they're seeing a bit of a danger to ideals that they cherish. And that's what we saw during these elections. We saw that they probably wanted him. They probably wanted Prime Minister Modi, but they didn't want him to be as powerful as he had been over the last 10 years.
This book is taking you years to write. So when you set out to write this book and when you finish this book, did it reconfirm what you started out, or did you find yourself changing, or did you find yourself having what I call Eureka, which every writer has a Eureka moment? Don't mean you're lying in the bath, but when you go, ah, okay, now I kind of understand what it is.
So this book began in a really strange way. It was 2016 or 2017, and I was on the investigative desk at Reuters. I was one of two investigative journalists they have in India. And at that point, India was debating this biometric identification project, which was essentially based on this idea that had done the rounds in the UK back in 2008, when the UK was trying to put an identification project in place, but then they shut it down. India said, the UK is thinking about it. It's a great idea. Let's do it ourselves. And there were really no questions about it, no discussions about it. It just happened one day. And you'd get calls from various people, you know, from various government departments, from banks telling you that if you don't have the number, you're going to be frozen out of your account. They're going to disconnect your phone line, all of that. And so there was an element of coercion to all of this. Now, I left my work at Reuters to say, I want to know why this identification project happened. And so I took off. I had no plan whatsoever except to interview as many people as I could. I said, I'll be done within a year or 2 years. It's been 7 years since then. And so as I spoke to people, I started asking them questions about why we needed the system in the first place. I wasn't getting a convincing reply. And as I spoke to people, I just kept going deeper and deeper and deeper into the architecture of the system, about the CIA and all these other, you know, once you get into technology and you look at the origins of certain kind of technology, you start to wonder whether you're going a little crazy, because there are various global players involved. And so I went through that phase and I was going absolutely nowhere until I had a breakthrough one day where I found that the system had actually been designed 10 years before anybody had said it was. So I found the guy who designed it. I had a conversation with him and he said, well, you know, there was this really hardline Hindu right-winger who commissioned this project. And I remember sitting back and thinking, wait, what? I've never heard this story. So tell me a little more about it. And he told me about how this man who was, in fact, he was one of the leading figureheads of the Hindu right in India. He had called these consultants over to his place for a meeting and then told them that I need an identification system that will identify people on India's borders, will identify infiltrators. And by infiltrators, you know, we're talking about it in religious terms now. So I said, that's interesting. And I walked away from there and thought, all right, I've got to go check this out. And so when I pulled that strand, suddenly I found myself about 150 years in the past, trying to figure out the ideas that galvanize the right and why they're so angry and what exactly it is that they want. And I worked backwards and then forwards. and ended up in modern day India.
I'm going to run out of time because I could probably talk to you for at least another hour about this because it is such a subject. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to continue the conversation?
Twitter at Rahul A. Bhatia.
The book is called The New India, The Unmaking of the World's Largest Democracy. It's by Rahul Bhatia. You can also order the book online for our own virtual bookstore as well. Rahul, sorry I had to cut you short, but it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, Giles.